Hello and welcome to the next episode of The Break Breakdown. I'm your host, Courtney, and I'm so excited for you to listen to this next episode today. My guest was Kimberly Dotson, who is an actor, performer, dancer, activist, founder of Everybody Black, and she was performing on Broadway up until the pandemic hit. She has been in the Donna Summer musical. She was in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, that little ditty before everything shut down. And she is the founder of Everybody Black, which is this incredible organization that basically helps the community in the theater industry organize for fair wages, equitable treatment, and anti-racism efforts. An incredible human being. We talked so much about how there is just racism and sexism within the theater industry. And I think this is such an important episode, and Kimberly's thoughts are so important to get out there, and her work is so important to get out there, because I think a lot of times people assume theater, entertainment, show business, it's just, you know, we're so progressive and we're so open and tolerant and friendly to different types of people. And, you know, it's really important to see all the ways in which white supremacist culture filters into every part of our culture, every part of our society. And Kimberly does just amazing work with Everybody Black, which she'll talk more about during the interview, to really counteract that space and create a more equitable world by bringing people together for justice, for dignity, respect, workers' rights. And I think it's just an incredible conversation. I felt like I was just ready to, I'm always ready to keep talking to everyone, but I really felt like Kimberly and I were like, there was just so much more that we could say and so much more we could dive into and so much more I wanted to learn from her. And so this is just the tip of the iceberg. But I really hope you enjoy it. She's a phenomenal human being. Can't wait to see her back on the stage when that happens. And yeah, hope you enjoy. Kimberly, I'm so excited for you to be on The Break Breakdown. I have been told by people that I adore and love and trust that you are someone I need to talk to. And then in doing research about you and reading, you know, just about how you have come into the present moment with your work now and your professional journey and everything like that, it's like, I'm really, really, really excited for everyone to hear your story today. And what's funny is you and I went to the same college.
Yep.
But at very different times. Mm-hmm. I went before you. And we went to the same school, which I think is kind of cool in, you know, I don't know if all programs are like this, but I feel like if you and I got into a room together and we're acting or, you know, we're putting together a piece or something, mm-hmm. we'd have a shorthand. Like, even though we didn't go at the same time, I feel like we'd, you know,
yeah,
be able to communicate.
Definitely. Probably. We all know, our verbs, our actions very well at Muhlenberg mm-hmm. College. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but it's also, you know, about 12 of us went to Muhlenberg. So
it's true. Not a university program, a liberal arts small. I mean, probably when you went was like huge compared to when I went, even, you know, just in the way that things exponentially grow. And yeah. My first question about that is actually, you know, it fascinates me how people make the transition from, you know, whether it's their hometown or they go to college or something like that, but mm-hmm. the transition into professional theater yeah. and the transition into whatever, professional industry you're in. But I remember thinking, like in high school, like, how do you know where to go? How do you know what to do? And a lot of those questions are brass tacks that you can figure out and ask people. But I think there's yeah. also an inner figuring out, like, how do I fit here?
Absolutely.
How do I exist? So I would love to know about your transition from, you know, college to the professional world, what that was like.
Oh my goodness. I was thinking about this the other day, actually, because my therapist is helping me with gratitude, as we all go through this moment. Right?
Yes.
And she told me to start practicing self-gratitude, which is very difficult for me. I am a person who, you know, at the end of the day, I haven't done enough. And so I had this thought, I had this thought about, how old was I, 21, 22 year old Kimberly. I moved to New York directly after Muhlenberg. Like, I did summer music theater and then moved that fall. And I realized the other day, I was like, I truly just began, like, without thinking that I was ever going to go back home. I had enough money to stay for like 6 months. I got an agent from our showcase, which I think when you were there, they did not have that, but we had an industry showcase and I got an agent from it, which was amazing. So it was lucky that I had this group of people that was like, okay, time for you to go to auditions now. But I just immediately started like trying to find a job, trying to find a struggle job. I think now it like almost felt second nature, which is so strange, but I think there was just something about 22 year old me. And I think it's still in there. I'm just like, all right, you're here. Got to go get it. Got to do it. This is what you're supposed to do. I have a lot of feelings about Muhlenberg, and one of them is that they did not teach me anything. they did not prepare us at all to be working actors. Once we get a job, we're all very good and very talented and very intelligent actors. However, it was only that showcase that told us, like, okay, here are casting agencies that you need to know. You need to know that these casting agencies cast these shows, and that, you know, you need to actually be involved in the industry in a way that you were not prepared to in college at all. You need to be knowledgeable about who's casting, who's directing. So yeah, it's strange now because I don't really have some story of like, this was some immense struggle or anything like that. I felt like I just got there and was like, all right, let's go. Let's hit the ground.
I think that's really interesting. I also think back to that time when I was 21, 22, 23, yeah, and auditioning. I remember my dad said to me, like, well, how much? He's like, when are you moving to New York? Like, literally the day I came home from Muhlenberg graduation. I was like, well, I don't know, Dad. I need money. I don't have any money. Mm-hmm. I've been in college. They took all my money. Yeah. And he was like, well, how much do you think you need? And I was like, I don't know, $10,000. I just like pulled it out of my head. I was like, 10 grand. And he's like, well, then go make 10 grand and then go to New York.
Yep.
And I mean, there's that's a whole story for another time, how I eventually like did all that and got there. Mm-hmm. But there is something that I think is almost incredulous as you're looking back. You're like, how did I do that? But there was no way I was never, there was no way I wasn't going to do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to move to New York since I was three.
Right.
And even though I went to Muhlenberg thinking actually that I was going to be a concert dancer.
Oh.
And it wasn't until I auditioned for both programs for the scholarship that Charlie Richter was like, you can do both. You should do acting and dance. And I was like, okay. Yeah. Whatever. So when I was leaving school, it was automatic. I was like, I know exactly where I'm going. I know exactly what I have to do. But yeah, it's already planted in us of like,
yeah,
this is what we have to do. This is what I'm going to do. I have no other choice now.
Yeah. This is my life. And yeah, it's just such a funny thing. Cause you're like, I can't imagine what it'll be, but there's an inevitability to it of like, yeah, that this is what it's going to be. And one of the big things about moving to New York, obviously, and becoming a professional actor is, you go to auditions, yeah. which, as you said, are different than college auditions, or at least from our college, completely different.
Drastically different.
Understatement of the century.
Yeah.
And when I was acting, well, yes, because now I'm writing and directing, but mm-hmm. came to it through acting. When I was acting and I was auditioning in the city, I mean, I wrote a whole book about auditioning in the city because there was enough to say. So yeah. I'm really interested in your experience of the audition system.
Oh my gosh.
Theater.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's completely archaic, right? Yeah. And I think we all grow up thinking that we have to go through this thing because we all watched A Chorus Line or like the making of A Chorus Line. And we think that we should be in a room with 500 other women sweating our life away, paying, you know, $500 for our photos. And making up resumes with our like college, our college credits on them that don't matter because you were cast as an 80-year-old when you were 20, you know, like it just doesn't matter. There's also something like what I used to be really bad at auditioning because I was so nervous. And once I realized that it was a game, a giant game of just one, them testing you a lot of the times to see if, you know, you can go through usually the stuff that they went through, especially in dance auditions. But that if you start thinking about it as A, this is my dance class for the day. B, I don't have to go to every audition. And I know friends who did not and have not figured that out yet. But that's the one thing that I think a lot of people come out of college thinking that they have to go to everything. And that's just a waste of time. There's no reason for you to wake up at 5 a.m. for anything, but especially not a regional theater show that you don't really care about, but you just want a book. So you're going to get paid $400 to do Mary Poppins. Like, no.
You're paying $400 now? I remember my first gig out of school was $250 a week. And I'm happy to take it.
Crimes. But yeah, as soon as you start like going in and just saying like, I'm going to show my best self and have fun. And also just seeing the television show that is walking into an open call and walking into it's funny after a while. Yes. It's just, you know, it's all ridiculous of the stretching and the talking about what shows you've been in and that you know the director and the core and all of that. It's just all like the strange simulation of the Matrix that like is meant to bother you.
Wait. I got chills up and down my body because first of all, okay, for two reasons. First of all, you're literally, I did write a book about this and then I wrote a pilot about this and literally wrote these scenes out. And so you're saying like the pilot back to me, which is funny. Secondly, I just talked with an amazing person last week or 2 weeks ago, Grace Baldridge, and they also said something about breaking out of the Matrix.
Yeah.
And I think it's, and they are not in the New York theater dance scene. They're mm-hmm. a musician and a filmmaker. And so it's really interesting to me that language is there because it does feel very surface level for us now. Like, I didn't think we were going to get this to this question this early in the interview, but I love that we did because I really want to know about, like, there's a theater system in New York, right? It's like we live in the system of the United States of America. We understand this capitalist structure. Right. Then there's art making. Mm-hmm. And we think, right, as a 22-year-old woman coming into that, you're like, I'm here to make art. Thank you.
Yeah, no.
Right. Okay, so can you talk to me, tell me your thoughts on or experience with like, how does, well, oh man, which direction do I want to go? Yeah. Okay. How does art fit into capitalism? And then after you answer that question, I want you to talk about like the Broadway New York theater industry system.
Yeah. Goodness, there's so many. I mean, first of all, I think especially coming out of Muhlenberg, I really thought that I was going to be changing the world. Like, I really thought that I was going to be doing what they taught us of putting a mirror up to society and like really doing the thing that changes minds and expectations. And I was a performance studies minor. So I was literally studying social movements as performance and all of these things, right? And then my first job, I work on a cruise ship. So I think, you know, we have this expectation, and I've gone back and forth with this question of like, what does it mean, or can art be actually made within capitalism? And no one ever taught us that art was without exploitation. So we, you know, sort of come with these like romantic ideas of what art can be. But my feeling right now in this moment is that, you know, art exists obviously in capitalism. My hope is that the workers, right, the artists, see themselves as workers and put up a fight. That's the problem that I've had where, you know, if you're going to do Mrs. Doubtfire the musical, look, that's fine, but pay your performers what they're owed. I was reading the other day because, you know, this moment has brought up so many things for me in terms of the theater industry and what it means to be a theater worker, an arts worker, which is a new term right now, which is really exciting. But I keep often coming back to Hamilton, and I am not a Hamilton stan. I do not think the pieces of it that are revolutionary, that people think are revolutionary, are just, you know, whatever. It's just black. That's what it is. You're like, oh, black people on stage and rapping, and it's just blackness. That's, you're excited about it. But what's actually revolutionary is what nobody talks about, what happened in, I think it was 2016, that the original cast who were in the development fought for profit shares of the show. Yep. And I'm like, and everyone thought in that moment that that was going to be such a massive moment that would bleed out into the rest of the Broadway industry. We completely forgot about it. And I think that's the part that I'm like, look, it's inevitable that, you know, if something like Broadway is going to continue to exist, there's going to have to be that balance of something like Hadestown, which is not devoid of exploitation, right? There are still people who are getting paid far more than what they should and far less than what they should. Opposite, I will always bring up Mrs. Doubtfire the musical because it was the last thing to be open before we closed. But that's always going to be, you know, head to head. That art exists, that beautiful, you know, transformative art exists. And even the fun, kitschy stuff like Mrs. Doubtfire, you know, is art and fun. It's the feeling to me of what are you going to pay, literally, your performers? What are you going to pay the people who make the wigs or your stage managers who are getting, you know, a PSM could get like $400 or $200 on a Broadway contract, while, you know, a white guy who's doing maybe three songs gets $10,000 a week because he's the lead. And then don't ask what the producers are getting, you know, and don't ask what the theater owners are getting. So yeah, it exists. It's there. Art within capitalism happens all the time. We're living in it. It's just about, you have to fight it, you know, which is the hard thing, because you don't want your art to be, you don't want to give it a number, right? What is it worth? But if you're going to be a part of it, you have to.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're saying that's such a brilliant point about, because I completely forgot about Hamilton and the profit shares. Yeah. Of course I did, right? But you're so right. It's like we live in a capitalist system. So it's there. You can't, even if you're like, I don't believe in capitalism or I don't like capitalism. It's like, okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
You live in a capitalist system. You're not just by saying, I don't like it doesn't mean you're not within the system. Right. But I think that there is this thing with artists and with art workers and with, you know, people who are often found, not often found, but are in the group of people working in theater who are easily exploited.
Right.
That it's like, just be happy for what you can get.
Exactly.
So, yep. So there's that part of it. And then there's the tension with the back of your brain that's like, I know what art is supposed to do.
Right.
And for some reason, I want to be doing that. I'm not getting paid. Something doesn't feel right. I'm supposed to be happy about this. What is wrong with me?
Yeah.
And we bring it in on ourselves as if like we're the crazy ones when it's just like, no, it's like we live in a crazy system.
Yeah. Well, that was my life on Broadway. That is my life on Broadway. I did 2 Broadway shows. I mean, and nothing ever felt like I was supposed to really be there. It's just like, this is, you know, this is all right, but this doesn't feel like what I'm supposed to be doing. There's so many pieces of it. It's like, one, you're not getting paid enough. Yeah. When you take the time to actually, you know, crunch your own numbers in your head and do the searching that they don't want you to do. And you're like, what is Broadway making for New York City again? Oh, okay, and how much am I getting paid? Okay, and how much is rent in New York City? Okay, and I have to get how many weeks for healthcare? Okay, and who choreographed this show where they hired a bunch of Black people? Who's directing the show where they hired a bunch of Black people, but I don't see myself within the creative team? Okay, you know, there's all of these pieces where it's like, especially for me as a Black woman, not only are you not paying me enough for what I'm doing, but inevitably you're going to say something racist and you're going to say something sexist. Yeah. So, you know, we're inevitably coming to work every day ready to fight. So it's that piece of like, I feel like I'm being exploited. This is not a collaborative process at all, which is the thing that no one tells you about Broadway. You got, you know, millions of dollars and 2 months to put on a show. No one's asking you, you know, anything. You know, they're putting something on you. But, you know, talk about the systems. There's so many different systems. Just auditioning alone. Mm-hmm. Getting an audition the night before you need to go in. I have running screams about dance auditions because I'm like, there's no reason why dancers should come in blind. You're not looking for somebody who can pick up choreography quickly. Why don't you put the choreography online so that we can save ourselves the time and I can go, I don't need to go in for that. I don't need to risk my body for 30 minutes or an hour or all day. So to get a job that I shouldn't go in for, you know, there's so many things that trick you that are completely based in how much, right? How much you have, how much time and how much money you have. And that's how you play. If you have enough time and if you have enough money in New York City, and inevitably you don't have either.
You don't. And I remember, I remember people being like, if you're not in dance class and you're not taking voice lessons and you're not doing that, you're not doing the work. And I was like, I'm sorry, I work at a bar until however late at night and then go to an audition. When am I supposed to, and like audition for, I mean, I was one of your friends who didn't get the memo to not audition for everything until I was like 28. Mm-hmm. And then when I started making choices, my agent was like, bye-bye. And I was like, oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, it all worked out. But my point just being that, like, I was going to like 3 auditions a day, going mm-hmm. to a bar at night, getting yeah. completely sexually harassed by like the people there and my boss yeah. and whoever. Mm-hmm. And also just to say, like, as a white woman,
yeah.
pretty privileged moving through all of those spaces, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I think something that people would probably be surprised about the theater who are outside of the theater
yeah.
is how racist and sexist it can be.
Oh, goodness.
Because yeah. the idea outside of the theater industry is that, like, it's inclusive and, like...
Yeah, like a beautiful rainbow community of
yeah.
loving, hugging people who massage one another without us. Yeah, that's what it is.
Massage and, circles.
Yeah. Just
puppies. Just
puppies and massage circles. That's what yeah. we got our degree in, let's be real.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think honestly, there are people inside the theater industry who are surprised by it, who really believe that they are the epitome of, you know, inclusive, liberal, you know, utopia. But there are so many things that are racist within the theater community. I mean, you can break it down to hair. There are so few people on Broadway who can do black hair, who can do black wigs. In fact, I'm sure we'll get into everybody black, but one of my team members does hair. She did my hair in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. And she was telling me that there are two schools who teach how to do hair on Broadway. Neither of them teach anything about black hair. And their union refuses, up until she asked, I don't know if they're doing it now, but they refuse to teach black hair or make those classes accessible. There's racism in design. There's, you know, people do not know how to light black people at all.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's racism in makeup. First of all, people are surprised to know that if you get makeup provided for you on Broadway, that is, you got some really lovely producers, because makeup is not always provided. And if it is, then you probably have to find someone and say, look, this is not my shade. You need to find my actual shade of color. Nude tights, nude bras, all of these things, difficult. You know, just looking at the board members of any of the 3 organizations that own theaters in New York City, where are there people of color? Nowhere. The whole thing is white. And, you know, even just exactly auditions, working, black people have jobs. Yeah. It's very rare, you know, this whole industry is also about privilege. You got to buy shoes. You've got to buy the classes. You've got to buy voice lessons. All of those things are expensive. None of this is accessible even to the people who want to work in the industry. So when you invite me to a all day dance call from 10 to 5, and there are people like, I need to go to work. And casting has not figured out that they need to make this decision, this time period, way shorter for actually people who need to work. That, you know, that's another thing where they're not making it accessible to people of all class backgrounds, right? They don't actually care.
I mean, that feeling, I just, like, I haven't auditioned in such a long time, but that feeling of like, oh shit, I got to call someone at work, or I got to get someone to cover me, or that angsty feeling, because it's not about like, no, I don't want to go to that job. I really don't want to go there, but I have to, and I can't lose it.
Yeah.
I can't lose this job. It's yeah. So, I mean, as you're saying this, it's just like, I don't know if it's a different time that we're living in, or if it's just like, I'm a different person than I was when I was auditioning, but I always internalized it until I didn't, you know what I mean? Until like I was walking down the street and I had this epiphany that like I was doing what I wanted to do and it wasn't that glamorous.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still proud to be doing it. I was still grateful to be doing it. I was really happy that I was doing it. But it was, did you see Soul?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just watched it the other day with my daughter mm-hmm. and I was like sobbing. I was just like, yeah. Oh my God, this is the best movie of all time. It just hit me. And that moment where, well, I don't want to give away any spoilers.
Spoilers.
I don't do any spoilers. But the idea that like your life is the big break. Your life is the thing. Yeah. And we're like indoctrinated in a certain sense to believe yeah. that
very young.
Very young.
Yeah. I mean, I've been dancing pre-professionally since I was 10. Right. And that, you know, very early on, when I was 10, I was like, this is my passion. You know what I mean? Like this is what I was born to do. And I felt very lucky 10 to 18. I was like, I'm so lucky that I figured out what I want to do at such a young age. And it is who I am, you know? And, you know, then we get told about this scarcity that we should be lucky that we get a job at all, that there are very few people who have their big break, quote unquote. And then once you make your big break, like what happens then? There's just, you know, you just pass through some threshold that you don't know what happens on the other side. And I had a really hard time when I first got on Broadway because it wasn't how I expected. I was excited, but I didn't feel like this is it. This is what I've been waiting for my whole life. I was already doing the show that was just about to move to Broadway. You know, we were on our way to doing the show when my agent called and was like, you're going to move with the show. And I was like, great, you know, fantastic. But, you know, they don't tell you. And I will say this for me, because I think there are people who love the lifestyle, who are like, this is my passion, this is what I was meant to do, I love the community, all that, I don't need to ask any questions, right? But for me, I got there and felt, okay, this is a job. This is just another job. I feel very lucky that I get to do what I've been training to do. I understand that this is a really rare opportunity. And there's a lot of things that need work here. This is an industry. I would like a lot of things to change. You know, this is not perfect. It's still racist. It's still sexist. I don't see anybody who looks like me. I sort of feel the heavy weight of still going to work, getting on the subway and, you know, getting in at half hour and stretching and putting on makeup. I still feel that weight, and it's capitalism. That's what it is. That's what you feel of like, I have to do something for money. And that is sort of the weight that I always felt. And it was very hard to explain it to my friends who wanted to be on Broadway, who wanted to be where I am. To explain to them, no, this is just another gig. It pays more, you know, but you're still gonna go through the same bullshit. If you care about, you know, the accolades and people being like, oh my God, you're on Broadway, then it'll matter to you. But for me, it's great. And it was something that I got to check off. And it was actually more important for my family to see my family, see me, you know, hit that mark. But I don't think that I or any of the people who I worked with are better or more talented because we're on Broadway than people who are non-union who work at regional theaters. You know, right. I don't consider myself like somehow better. So didn't matter to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we could talk for hours about like the hierarchy that's built into the whole theatrical system in New York and how people are like, you know, talking about Broadway, but not talking about regional theater and talking about, you know, whatever. There's a lot of different things going going on there. But it's interesting what you said about you got into the system and then you were like, all right, this is an industry I need to fix.
Yeah.
You guys need to fix this, because the premise of this podcast, coming out of my own personal work as a filmmaker and a writer, is based on the premise of like, okay, we want to break into these systems. We want to break in. We want our big break. But then once we get there, we want to change the system from the inside out.
Mm.
So how do you do that, Kimberly?
Goodness. Well, you don't do it alone, is all that I believe, which is why I started Everybody Black. It came out of the summer of quarantine in 2020. And, you know, I saw those black squares on, you know, Broadway shows, and just nothing made me more angry. I think I wrote a list of demands in like March. I was just ready to just get going. And it's because I had an incident in Harry Potter where a crew member wasn't really saying things directly at me, but he was going to other black women in our show and saying things like, I like my coffee, like I like my women dark and bitter, like all of these just horrendous things. And this person had been working at the theater, and I went to stage management and went to company management, had a meeting with them and requested anti-racist training. In addition to our sexual harassment training, anti-sexual harassment training, which happened at the same time. But I was just, you know, that feeling that you get that's almost animal when you feel like, you know, your mouth is watering for how much you want to just bite the necks off of other human beings. That's what I felt this summer. And so basically once I got to Broadway, I wanted to organize it. Like, I would walk around sometimes and be like, man, if all of the Lion King went on strike, do you know how much money would be lost and what they could ask for? Like, those are the things that I was dreaming about backstage. And so with Everybody Black, I found women from all different facets of the theater, because that's one thing that they do really well in terms of systems, is that we are all in different unions. And so we have no idea what's going on, even upstairs. So I talked to a woman from marketing, which, talk about racism, Broadway shows just do not market to people of color. I have a woman in hair and makeup, a woman in costumes, a stage manager, a woman who does educational theater, a woman who's worked at the front of house, and a dancer, and myself. And it was really important to me to have all those facets, because it makes more power, more people power. So if there's somebody who works in marketing and is trying to get their marketing firm, who's marketing for Broadway theaters, to get them to actually reach out to people of color and black people, they will have more power if the actors on stage and if the people in hair and makeup and the people who are doing wigs know that's going on, right? And so if we can get all of us to say, okay, look, I want to be in a show that markets to people of color. I also want to be in a show that actively hires people of color. I also want to be in a show that has anti-racist training. I also wanted to be in a show that does costume design specifically thinking about black bodies. I also want to, you know, all of these things together, then we have way more power. That's my thinking. I don't know if it works. You know, I think that there's going to be and has to be people who are working from the outside, because there is potential for backlash. There is potential for people to maybe not get work after they ask for something, which is just the reality of the organizing that we're doing. But my thinking is that if we get enough of us to realize there's a lot of like deconditioning and unlearning that has to happen within the industry.
Yes.
That, you know, is its own process. But just the basics of letting us all realize, one, we are an industry. Two, together, we have power. That the people have the power. There are three people up there who own the theaters. They cannot do anything without us, you know? We are not asking yet for more money. We're asking for basic human decency. You can't say racist shit at work anymore and get away with it.
Yeah.
You can't sexually assault or sexually harass people at work. We are an industry. You can't do it. Mm-hmm. So I think the only way to do it is organizing. The only way to do it is with as many people as you can. Start building coalitions within your theaters. My dream is that there's a, you know, a Lion King coalition and a Wicked coalition. And, you know, we get the news that Lion King is asking for something. And then us outside can go, hey guys, Lion King is asking for something. How can we help you? How can we assist you? What do you need from us? How can we amplify what you need? 'Cause that's the only way. You can try to do it alone. And I think there are little ways of like, especially if you have the power within the industry already, to say, look, I want this in my contract. You know what I mean? I want anti-racist training in my contract already. I want to make sure that this happens. I want to know what I'm getting paid in comparison to other people, you know, or just talking about it amongst your cast and crew members. What are you guys getting paid? Making and normalizing those things. But I think the only way to really see and begin to make the changes that we want is with other people.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking about any movement ever that has been successful. It is exactly what you're talking about. And it makes me wonder too, when you were starting Everybody Black and talking about it and going to people, did you find any resistance from people? Were people like, I don't want to, or was it a time where everyone was just like, I want to bite the necks of everyone around me and let's go, let's do this.
No, there's definitely resistance. And I feel like, you know, I still see it. We're working on our initial campaign and, you know, people are afraid. We haven't worked for nearly a year. Our union has done very little to make sure that anybody works. In fact, they're still taking our health weeks, which is very cute of them. So,
And paying dues.
Yeah. Our entire union will be without healthcare by June. So I think people are worried. I also think it's so against our nature as an industry, right? It's we are happy with Skittles and peanuts if it means we can put it on our resume. It is very outside of us. And I found that very early on when I became a part of the Broadway community, that I felt like this, you know, loud little radical that I was like, y'all see what I see? And it was silence, you know? If I had said, which I had thought about, you know, guys, let's go after the top theater owners, you know? People would be like, yeah, sure. Tell them that they, you know, owe me money or whatever. So there are people that are fearful, but it was amazing. So my entire team is Black women and each and every one of them, and I didn't know a lot of them before. I got their names through other people and all of them were like, yeah, bet, let's go. Which is incredible. And we had to do work, you know, amongst us in the group of like normalizing and feeling comfortable with what we do as an organization, which is run campaigns, which is what we want to do, of a series of actions that leads to gaining something, right? A win. And in people's minds, it was like, oh, we're going to strike. It's like, no, 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 no. That's the last thing that you do, right? And so going through that training, and we went through a training with an organization called Corporate Accountability, and just normalizing for us that we are a part of a longer legacy of organizing, right? This is nothing new. We are not doing anything out of the ordinary. The reason why we have a union right now is because of this kind of work, right? Like realizing that we together are actually very powerful, and that we together can keep each other safe and hold these people accountable at the same time. But there's absolutely been this fear of even the idea of demanding, quote unquote, anything from anybody in power, which to me is so sad, but I understand it, but it's
completely. I mean, I think it's fascinating the point you bring up that like internally your group of founding members had to normalize it because again, we live in a system that will do everything it can to make you think you're the only one.
Yeah.
Everything it can to make you think you're crazy for wanting more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you know, if we look at the general thing, like the minimum wage should be $23 an hour or something like that. And we're fighting for 15 and people are like, whoa, too soon. It's like,
whoa, yeah.
Are you kidding me? Are we looking at inflation? But you know, this is, I mean, that's one example, but I think it's so smart too, and to steep it in the history, you know, you're picking up a baton.
Yeah. It's,
even if you are alone, which you're not, but even if someone is alone, you're not.
Yeah, you're
people
not.
Went before. People will go after, and you do your part and do as best as you can. Exactly. I mean, do you think that like, with the pandemic kind of showing all the cracks, all the facade of it all, and not just theater, but culture in America, the racism, the you know, generational, just complete trauma of our national history.
Yeah.
Do you feel like we're going to come through on the other side of the pandemic being like, all right, we see what's going on. Let's start, maybe not let's start fresh, but I'm, you know, is there going to be a feeling of like, all right, we got to hit this differently? Or do you think there's going to be a feeling of like, that was so hard. Please just give me my job. I'll take whatever I can get. You know what I mean? Like what do you
think? From what I know of humans in my 30 years of living so far, there's going to be a handful of people who are just going to pretend like nothing happened, that everything is normal. And, you know, my politics are that we fight for them still. And if we have to fight them, we will. But those are potential allies and they'll just probably take longer. But I do think that, there's just, again, because of the system that we're in, people are gonna need money, people are gonna need jobs. My hope, and this is really the reason why I created this thing with these women, Everybody Black, to make sure that we normalize the work that is already happening right now and continue it and uplift it where it's happening in smaller places, in smaller regional theaters, because that will inevitably happen. Mm-hmm. It will be, it makes me shiver. And my heart sinks because I know it. I know that feeling. I can imagine walking into rehearsal and just wanting it to feel normal and falling back into these cycles and these systems that we've already played into, because this is what we know how to do. You see the director and he makes an offhand joke and you laugh, even though you don't want to, but you laugh because you feel like you want him to hire you again. Or you hold your tongue when somebody says something because you don't want to be the person who makes things difficult for the room. This is just how we have been conditioned to act as Black women specifically, as women specifically, that we walk into a room and we often are told to make ourselves smaller. But my hope is that if we build enough right now, people will walk into rooms knowing that they're not alone. That you, because I already know that feeling of like, there's nobody who's going to be by my side if I'm the one who's loud about this. But if you walk into a room already knowing that there's a group of women, there's an organization that you can go, already this thing is weird. Already this work has not been done. I need some support. What should I do in these situations? What should I do at my workplace? Then you already feel like you have way more people, you know, on your side and more support. And so also that you don't have to be the only person who says something, that maybe you don't feel comfortable saying something at work, but you can call somebody outside of your work and that can amplify what's happening at your workplace for you. So I know that there's going to be that retreat. It's already happening. There's going to be that need that you have to keep yourself safe in order to make that money. But my hope is that the work that my organization, all these other organizations, there's a lot of great organizations that have come out of this movement in the theater organizations specifically, theater industry specifically, that will make people, individuals, feel like they actually have more help and that they're not alone. Why should anybody believe that anything will be different? You know what I mean? Why would, you know, why should anybody walk in feeling safe already? You shouldn't. Nothing has ever told you that anything is going to be different. We're also fighting really, like you've said, this much larger system that we can't fight, which is capitalism, you know? So we're just trying to make these small steps that even, you know, these theater organizations are already fighting, so.
Right. Well, and thinking about someone walking in and at least being aware that I wish this doesn't feel right, and it's not because of me, it's because of someone else, is, I think, like, for someone who might not be ready to like really take a stand, that's something you can do in your own mind, is try to re-educate yourself from your miseducation and try to unlearn things and try to, you know, decondition yourself to think like, if this feels wrong, it's wrong.
It feels wrong
to me, it's wrong. And that's fine. And then when you're ready, you reach out and whatever. But that, I think, is like a tangible step. Well, it's not really tangible. It's actually an intangible step, but like one step that people can make. And then the other thing that I would love for you to talk about a little bit is, I think it's fascinating, and maybe I'm just like super late to the game and like all I do is like work and take care of my child, and so like I don't get it. But I love that you introduce everyone's bio in Everybody Black.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, can you talk about it and like what you do and how you do it and why you do it?
Yeah, so we had this conversation really early on in creating our organization of normalizing the fact that we work for companies. that this is not some dreamy, you know, landscape that we live in. If you work for Mean Girls, right, it's really not, I'm, you know, in the ensemble at Mean Girls. No, Mean Girls LLC writes your checks, right? You know? And so I think, so what I did, I can't remember, but I wrote, you know, Donna Summer LLC and what is it, Train Times LP. I was previously employed by them is what I said. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's this transition that's already happening, which I want it to continue of, you know, we've got Be an Arts Hero. They call people arts workers, normalizing the phrase theater workers. Just making everyone, pulling back this romantic curtain of what it means to be on Broadway. And this sort of like celebrity curtain as well. And put forward, this is a company that writes my checks. I work for somebody else. I don't own anything. I am employed. I am an employer, you know, I'm an employee. And just normalizing that, because I feel like even within our community, like we've said, we are taught to believe that we do this. We don't do this for the money, right? We do it because it's our passion. We do it because this has been our lifelong dream. And as long as we continue that narrative, they will continue to pay us Skittles and peanuts.
Right.
To do a black backflip, you know, on stage 8 times a week, and also puppeteer, and also be the dance captain, you know, like, and, you know, not give us healthcare. They will continue to do that. So long as we walk into the room and somebody says, you should be happy to be here. There are people waiting for, you know, to take your spot outside. As long as we continue to internalize that, they will continue to treat us
right.
The way that they are.
Right. And yeah, I mean, what else is that other than exploitation to say right. Someone really wants to do something? We live in a culture that is allergic to art. So we're going to take your deep need and want. Mm-hmm. And make you take, you know, whatever.
Whatever you can get. We're going to teach you that you basically have no value, that you're incredibly replaceable to the point where we're going to have these open calls and show you that 500, 600 people are all up for this job. And you were chosen out of all of those people. And so here's what we're going to offer you. $200 and you have to get to Virginia, let's say, on your own, and we'll provide housing, but the housing should be condemned. And you know what I mean? Like
my first job, the cast housing didn't have a lock on the front door.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. We had to hunt down checks. And look, here's the thing too about regional theater. I'm not even saying those people at that regional theater even wanted it to be that way.
Exactly. Yep.
Like they were doing the best, I believe, mm-hmm. They were doing the best that they could in a society, in a system that was not interested in supporting them. But should they leave? Should we lose all the theater, all the art making in the world? Mm-hmm. People would go batshit crazy.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, and it's not like, I don't say that like art heals. No. I'm just saying that there's like an intrinsic human desire to make meaning. Yeah. And we can't just make meaning with science. That's beautiful. We can't just make it with math. That's beautiful. There has to be, like, we have to accept our humanity.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Have you seen Pretend It's a City?
Yes. And I was going to bring that up earlier. Wait, tell me.
Like, wait, what is bad? I can't remember her name.
Franley Woods.
Yeah. Franley Woods. I was like, I know it's an L in the last name, but yes, my girl, Franley Woods. I think it was the fifth episode when she was just like, how much do we pay taxes for a sports stadium?
Yes.
And she's like, these things like the Lincoln Center and, you know, all of these arts institutions are a part of life and are necessary to human beings. Yeah, I think it's so difficult, the art and, you know, America conversation, because yes. It's just so split. It's just like, there's a piece in our minds that has been broken. There's also something that the theater industry, and I will also spill out to the dance industry, isn't doing, is that it's inaccessible, right?
Right.
So movies and television are extremely accessible. They don't even really like connect those things as an art or artistry. It's almost just like, this is the box that is in front of me always.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know anybody who regularly is paying $500 to $1,000 to go to the theater, to go to dance. There are different cities that are better at reaching out to the community and normalizing it. However, just generally in, you know, American culture, we're not really interested in anything that's live or on stage, or, you know, even live music, it's very rare. So I think there's just like this strange split in their brain. So it's like, not only do we have to get people to see us as artists, as something to value, but also that this is an industry,
right,
that is important to the making and the culture and the money of a city. You know,
yes.
That's, you know, it's a hard thing to have to teach, you know, a literal entire culture.
A literal entire culture, Kimberly. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's also where the tension resides in people who are, you know, just really trying to make it in theater, or really trying to make it as, especially as actors and dancers who take in work and, you know, if you're not necessarily creating your own work, you're just always waiting for someone to give you an opportunity. And yeah. I think that's a really difficult space to define yourself in, because you're like, I am an artist, but my output depends on someone else. And it's like, we work in a collaborative profession, but the collaboration, like you said, like there's no real collaboration when you get into making money, like millions of dollars of money.
Yeah. In commercial theater, it's just, it's very rare that, you know, somebody will ask you what you think.
Yeah.
It's very difficult because you feel like you're meant to be I mean, I'll speak for myself. To me, it's sometimes hard to call myself an artist because I feel like I've been taught that I should be creating always, and especially during this time, it's completely impossible. But what I realized I'm doing is that I'm bringing somebody else's vision to life, and you know, that's lovely and amazing work. I mean, truly, actors and dancers, we turn some serious poo-poo platters into gold. I have read somebody sat on a computer and that script that they created. And I'm watching an actor and I'm like, oh my God, way to give that moment real life and vision and a background story and, you know, emotion. So, you know, we are actually, you know, we're creators. We're making things beautiful all the time.
100%.
But it's hard to live in both of those spaces of like, oh, here I am, like, making somebody else's dream come to life.
Yeah.
Being paid $2
to do it. Yeah. I mean, and that is another thing that I felt like in the best jobs that I had as an actor and a dancer, in the best scenarios, I felt like my opinion was valued and I felt free to do it how I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
In the worst case scenarios, they were like, well, the girl
before you,
the girl before you did it this way, and it always got a laugh. And I was like, do you understand that we have over 2 decades of different experiences? My voice hits differently. I'm shorter than her, like, whatever. It's like, and so I guess my point in saying it is that, you know, actors and dancers and singers and people who do bring other people's work to life are create are it's so tough for other people to I shouldn't say tough. People lack imagination, and they lack understanding, and they lack respect of actors and dancers and singers, because they're creating in the moment on the line. Yeah. Everything is a creation.
Yeah.
You know, the people who did the film that we shot last year, those actors, those arts workers, they took everything that I watched them do from the time that I said action to cut was theirs.
Yeah.
I wasn't in that scene. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
there is real work that's going on, but we were living in this constant tension of like the intangible, which is the human mm-hmm. experience mm-hmm. and the capital.
Yeah.
Which is the economic experience. And I will say though, just talking to you and hearing your experience of being on Broadway and also hearing what your vision is going forward and what it can be without it. I mean, you see things clearly, you know, I think you see things very clearly. And I do think I feel hopeful about it. I feel like, you know, if you're saying it out loud, then there are other people maybe whispering it to themselves somewhere too.
Oh yeah, totally. It's important to say your dreams out loud so you make sure that they happen. There's not much, I think that there are a lot of things that can change that'll just make the experience of working commercial theater and working on Broadway just more livable mm-hmm. and make it feel like, you know, perhaps one can thrive. Mm. I don't know how much within the system can change. I think that there will be new producers, or maybe even old, but I don't really have much faith, but new producers, new directors who will come in to a project with new vocabulary to make it so this space is livable for their performers and for the people who work on the piece. But the reality is that for things, for example, like Hamilton or Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, that these are products that they are reproducing. And so there is a piece of it that's like, every performance is different, right? But there is also a piece of it that there are certain things that they want those characters to do and certain things that they want those characters to act like or say that are part of the product, right? That somebody in that development process, a real actor, right, came up with, that lived through in the moment, that became what is known as the character of Polly Chapman, or the character of Rose Granger Weasley, or the character of Angelica Schuyler, that is probably, you know, repeated over and over again to that actor. Whether or not that actor does that thing every night on stage, right, and, you know, lives freely in the moment is another thing. But when you're in these big pieces like this, you tend to see that, like, oh, there's a playbook here that is probably what they are talking about in Australia. Right. I don't know how much that's going to change. Right. However, you know, at the very least, hopefully there will be some sort of conversation, some transparency about that. That yeah. It's not like, this isn't actually a note that I'm giving you. This is a note that comes from way up above me,
right.
You know, that's like, that doesn't have anything to do with you or your work, you know?
Right.
Or like, I would love to play with this more, but we've got to keep it in a little bit of a contained thing because we don't want to take away, you know, so things like that. We can only hope, but I think that those artistry pieces, I don't know how much those can change, but those basic industry workplace things can absolutely and should absolutely shift. There's no reason why we should be you know, tormented and also feel like, you know, we're not doing anything artistically fulfilling.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. I wish, I was however many years younger and I could be in auditions with you and like sit and talk shit about everything because, I feel like, I would have really loved to know you then too. I'm glad to know you now though.
Yeah.
So what do you think, and this doesn't have to be about the system and capitalism and all that, although it can be, nothing wrong with that. But what do you think you misunderstood in your journey of being an artist? What do you think you misunderstood at the beginning that you understand a little bit better now?
I think what I was taught was that art must be sacrifice. And I don't think that's true. And I don't want that to be true. I was the kid who, I was dancing every day from 10 to 18. And then I went to college for it. And then, you know, then I left college and started jobs immediately. I've been working my literal butt off since I was 10. And I've missed a lot of stuff. I've missed a lot of birthday parties. I, you know, left home at 18. So I missed a lot of family stuff. And I think we're sort of taught that art is pain, art is sacrifice. And I think I misunderstood that. I think and I really, you know, these weird sort of silver linings of this pandemic. I know a lot of actors that I, pretty much all of my friends, we agree we wouldn't have taken any kind of break if it wasn't for the pandemic. There would be, none of us would be home as much as we are. None of us would even think about taking naps, you know, like it would never happen. I think I believed that the grind is what I was supposed to do, that I was, you know, kind of meant to suffer, especially living in New York. Let's be real. You know, you feel like you got to get a badge of honor of like, look, I woke up, somebody harassed me. Then somebody peed on the subway next to me, but I got to, you know, my call on time. And then, you know what I thought about before? I ordered food. So my food was at the theater before and, you know, whatever, you know, you feel like you have to have these moments of like destruction in order to claim yourself as an artist. But I feel like what I want myself to know is that you're allowed to thrive. You're allowed to make family and feeling safe a priority. You're allowed to slow down. It doesn't mean that you're not working hard if you say no to auditions. You're allowed to take care of yourself. You're allowed to have boundaries, all of these things. I mean, there are so many things about the life of being an artist that just weren't serving for me emotionally anymore. And I was coming to that realization already. I was actually gonna, you know, I was like, I'm gonna take a year off from Broadway. I wasn't gonna audition.
You did that to us? I'm just kidding.
Yep, I did. I was like, I'm not gonna audition for any shows unless it's Hadestown. I was like, if Hadestown brings me in, then I will audition and I will go back to Broadway if I get it. But you know, I'm not auditioning for anything else. I had already started the process of trying to, I call it, change my major and start directing. And I was gonna take a month off vacation, but I already felt like this isn't serving me anymore. And knowing that it doesn't have to, like this doesn't have to be the journey that you're living in. just because everyone else is living in it and has accepted it doesn't mean that you have to. You are allowed to be like, guys, tech rehearsal is really dumb. We should not be in the theater all day and just see darkness forever. Like, we should be able to go home. Yeah. You know, there are things that are normal that don't have to be the case anymore. So definitely that, just like, you don't have to suffer for your art. You don't have to. You shouldn't have to. You actually shouldn't. You shouldn't suffer for your art anymore.
We think we have to suffer for our art, but actually we have to suffer for capital.
Right. Exactly.
That's what we're suffering for, right? It's like art itself is completely free. Yeah.
And that's the something that we're like, we're all running around for that freedom that we felt when we were 10, you know, that first feeling where someone teaches you choreography and you're like, oh my gosh, this is how I express myself now. Yes. This is what it is. And I would love to be paid for this. How amazing. Or the first time when you inhabited a character as a young person and you're like, oh my gosh, this is so fun. I can do voices and I can, tell the story and look at me on stage and I can see my mom out there, you know, all of these things. And we're all, as artists and actors, especially as dancers, we have this childlike mentality. We want to play.
Yes.
We love being playful. That's what we're chasing. And that's what weighs us down of like this disgusting feeling of having to suffer for maybe 2 months of play that doesn't even give you enough money to stay in the city that you believe that that's the only place that you can play it, you know? Right. But yeah, we have to suffer through all of that. And I don't think we have to. I'm gonna figure out what.
Well, I'm sticking with you. So let's do that. Let's do that one.
Yeah.
That option.
Yeah.
Wow, Kimberly. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I really feel like you basically articulated my 20s. I mean, look, I was never on Broadway, but I had an inkling about it and I was off Broadway and I felt those things that you felt. And I think it's so powerful how you're able to articulate it. And you know what? It's like you said, like not everything is going to be perfect right away. And some things will never be able to be fixed without the entire system breaking down.
Yep. So
like some things in our lifetime might not see their fullest potential, but just hearing you talk about it in the way that you talk about it and thinking about how a lot of people are talking about it like this now, in their own, you know, circles and ways and experiences. I just feel like based off of that, I can't wait to see the art that comes out of it and the relationships and the movement, you know, I can't wait to see the movement. And thank you for your work.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It's, it's truly my pleasure. This is what I want this space to be. I'm dreaming of these little conversations that everyone's having.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Kimberly. I learned so much, put so many things in perspective for me, and got me actually really pumped to just think about, you know, the work we all need to do as we head out of this pandemic, whenever that happens, and moving forward and all that. So if you enjoyed this episode, please do me a favor and take a screenshot of it, share it on Instagram, and you can tag at Queensbird Films. If you're new to the podcast, Queensbird Films is kind of the overarching umbrella, the brand name, so to speak, that we filmed Screen Test under, what we're doing our next digital series under, and what this podcast kind of falls under. So tag us, share a screenshot, share with your friends. Every little bit helps. And thank you so, so much for tuning in.